on Ways and Means. And the Joint Committee on General Government and Natural Resource Subcommittee's briefing this morning. We have starting off with state bonding and debt issuance. Kate Richardson, Laura Lockwood McCall, and Jack Kenny. The Office of State Treasury and the Department of Administrative Services are represented there. So with that, could we begin? And would you state your name for the record, please, and we'll proceed.
Mr. Chair. Before you get started with that, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Co-Chair Schrader and I wanted to welcome the committee members to this briefing and thank those of you who are here and those who are on the way. As you know, we have arranged to have this same presentation presented three times today. Senator Schrader and I will be participating in the full presentation at the 1 o'clock showing. And so we will not be sitting through your entire meeting this morning and did not want anyone to think that it was for lack of interest in what the presenters have to say or for lack of respect for the process you're conducting. But we're going to get the full show at 1 o'clock. Thank you for chairing, Representative Jensen, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Very well. Mr. Chair, Madam and Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate Richardson. I'm Chief of Staff for the State Treasurer, and as many of you may know, and some of you are learning, the State Treasurer is responsible for issuing all the state bonds, and we are here to give you essentially a bonding 101 course, and I have brought, for today, professors. Laura Lockwood McCall is the Debt Management Director for the State of Oregon, and she works in, for the State Treasurer. And Jack Kenny here is with the Department of Administrative Services, the Capital Finance Section. First, Laura is going to give you an overview about the State Treasurer's role and just really the basics of state bonding, and we'll tag team with Jack on that. And we will, I think we'll be able to take some questions here, but we do have a pretty comprehensive PowerPoint here for you that should cover most of your questions, but of course, you're welcome to interrupt and ask at any time. So with that, we'll just move right into Laura's presentation, and I think you have it distributed to you on the dais, and of course, it'll be here on the screen.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning, committee. As Kate said, I have been the debt manager for the state for a little over 2 years, and the presentation you'll see today are components of things that I've also taught at state employee training programs, as well as things that we share with the rating agencies, which we'll talk a little bit about as well. So I'm going to cover a few definitions.
For the record, please.
Oh, excuse me. Laura Lockwood McCall, Office of State Treasurer. Thank you, sir. I'll cover definitions. I'll give you a very brief snapshot of the U.S. debt markets to help provide some context for the bonds that we sell as far as the larger debt markets. We'll talk briefly about what is a municipal bond and what is the state's credit rating. I'll talk to you a bit about Oregon's bonding process, but Jack will handle a little bit more detail about the capital projects that make it all the way to bonding. I will give you some insight into the state's debt trends for the last 20 years. I'll talk a little bit about the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission's debt capacity model and what the forecasts seem to be indicating as far as for the next several years. And finally, some comparison of our debt ratios to other states. What is a bond issue? Well, it's basically the process of borrowing money. It's an IOU to your investors. It's a certificate, it's a legal document that represents our promise to repay investors the money that we borrow for our various capital projects. It has scheduled principal and interest payments, just like your car loans and your mortgages, and it's probably the best way to think about it is it's just a very large mortgage with a lot of zeros.
So how big is this bond market? Many of you probably have investments in your portfolios that look like that. Treasuries, people have heard of. Perhaps some people have Fannie Mae's or Freddie Mac's, which are considered asset-backed. Well, you can see on the screen that municipal securities represent roughly 9% of the overall bond market in the United States, $2.2 trillion in 2005. So we're not the only ones who borrow. Obviously, school districts, counties, cities, water districts, power, all sorts of folks are in the municipal bond market, as is the state. Why do we issue? It's one of the major sources of funding of our long-term infrastructure and capital needs. Similar to the homeowner, you usually can't afford to pay cash for a house unless you, work for Google or maybe Goldman Sachs. So we need to borrow money. It allows us to acquire assets as we need them rather than when we have enough cash in the bank. It does spread the cost of those assets out over time because as we pay debt service over 20 or 30 years, different taxpayers and participants who benefit from the use of the facility pay their appropriate fair share. And finally, we take advantage of the fact that the state of Oregon, as well as local governments, if you issue bonds for governmental purposes under federal tax law, you're exempt from both federal taxation on the interest as well as state taxation, which means that investors in our bonds get to keep that interest and not have to report on their taxes. In exchange for that privilege, they're willing to lend us money at a much lower interest rate than they would otherwise do if we were in the taxable market. So that's one of the big benefits to all issuers of municipal bonds. What do we finance? Well, Jack's going to talk about some of the things in the governor's proposed budget. But historically, we've used various types of bonds and certificates of participation to finance correctional facilities, most of the major prisons in the state. We're doing a lot of work right now in the terms of transportation improvements, both lottery bonds we'll talk a little bit about, as well as highway user tax bonds to pay for many of the improvements that you see on the roads and highways in the state. Higher education and community colleges is another big user of our bonding. The state also issues a number of bonds that support local needs, including economic and rural development, single and multifamily housing loans, veterans home loans. We do small-scale energy loans, drinking and water pollution control, and a variety of other things where we don't necessarily pledge the general fund of the state, but we offer conduit financing for nonprofits, as well as for private businesses that meet certain tests under federal tax laws. What's a bond credit rating? Well, just like you, the homeowner who wants to take out a loan to buy a house, when the state wants to go to borrow money, we need to get someone to give us a credit score. Only in the case of a large institution like the state or businesses, there's major credit ratings to assess our degree of risk. In other words, how likely are we to repay these loans? Now, we know that we're going to pay everything back, but there are gradations and degrees of difference between different states around the country, cities, school districts, in terms of some of their underlying fundamentals that investors care about. And if you have a higher credit rating, you get rewarded. These are the three major rating agencies that are in the municipal market right now that we get credit ratings from. There are different rating schemes, but ultimately, all of them ultimately have triple A's with some big A's, some little A's, but triple A is the highest rated security. U.S. Treasuries, for example, are triple A, very highest quality. Then there's double A's, A's, triple B's with minuses and pluses and different little numbers, but ultimately, it's just a gradation as to degrees of risk. Finally, triple B minus is probably the lowest, and where if you go below it, you're no longer investment grade. As I said before, credit ratings will impact the interest rates we pay on our bonds, and it will affect, obviously, our overall borrowing cost of capital. What do they consider? Well, for general obligation bonds, which is sort of a yardstick you can measure all the 50 states, they look at the financial performance of our jurisdiction. They look at our governance framework and our management practices, our debt burden in terms of how much debt do we have based on various ratios, and finally our economic base and whether they see our prospects in the future growing or declining, which might have some impact on where taxes and revenue will go in the future. On revenue bonds, they look at all the various same factors,
Plus, they want to look at specific revenue stream. So, for example, on the lottery bond, they'll look at very specific elements of lottery revenue trends. Same thing with highway user tax. They'll take a look at statistics about use of our highways and various other sort of measures as to the likelihood of repayment. They'll look at our legal and financial agreements and any kind of rate covenants in terms of what we agree to say. Basically, we agree not to go into debt above a certain amount. This is a snapshot as of November of what the 50 states' credit ratings are with Standard & Poor's, and I'm not sure if it shows up well on the screen, but hopefully in your handout. And what you'll see is that it really varies throughout the country. On the left corner, I show currently what state, there's nine states that are rated at AAA, which is the very highest. And it kind of works its way down to Oregon, and we're in a group of AA minus. Now, we're still a very highly rated state. Again, these are very small variations between gradations, if you will. So the difference between us is a triple A and a AA minus. When we go to the credit markets, we may pay 5, 10, 15, 20 basis points, depending on where the whole yield curve is, and also how much investors in our state want to how badly they want our bonds. But generally, you can see that we're kind of in the lowest tier. Now, below us, I guess if that's some small consolation, is California, Washington, D.C., and Louisiana. You see a little bit highlighted for Wisconsin. They're AA minus like ourselves, but right now they're on a credit watch positive, which means that there's consideration by the rating agencies to upgrade them based on recent financial performance. This is a summary of where the state's been across all three rating agencies since 1990. I think our highest moment probably was in about 1996 when we were a strong AA across all three categories. And different agencies have different criteria, so you can see sometimes one's going up and one's going down, but they're all kind of fine-tuning their processes. One thing they did all agree on in 2003 was within a year all three agencies downgraded the state one notch during the height of the budget problems the state experienced. I think Fitch went a little too far, and they acknowledged that in 2005. We have been actively pursuing a rating upgrade and pushing very hard for the last 2 years that I've been here that the fundamentals of the state are strong and things are in the upswing. And we continue to make that case every chance we get whenever we go into the bond market when we meet with the rating agencies. For what it's worth, I'll give you some feedback if you're interested about what our credit worthiness is from the three rating agencies. This is sort of a compilation of all three perspectives. First, let's start with strengths. Among our strongest things that they mention is we have great, strong financial controls, whether that's budgeting, accounting, cash management, debt management. Across the board, they give us very high marks in that regard. They like our conservative consensus-based revenue forecasting process. Not all states are like that. Sometimes you have dueling revenue forecasts between the governor's office, legislative budget office, etc. And what they really want is consistency and consensus. It allows them to make value judgments in a clearer way where they can actually figure out what's going on. They applaud our constitutional balanced budget requirement. You'd think that would be sort of a standard thing in all states, and it's not. They appreciate the fact that the legislature takes their role very seriously in terms of oversight and their willingness to adjust budgets in response to changing revenue estimates. Some of you may remember back in the 2001-2003 era that the legislature needed 5 special sessions. Well, partially it's because the legislature needed to come in and adjust the budget downward as revenue forecasts were changing. I was living in California at the time, and that is not how the legislature behaved, and that's not how things operated. As difficult and painful as it may have been, the rating agencies hold Oregon in some regard for their willingness to do what they needed to do. We do have sound debt management and capital planning policies, as I hope you'll see as we go through this presentation. We do have, obviously, a growing economy with greater diversification of our economic base, and that's an important long-term consideration as they look out to the future and our ability to pay bonds not just today, but in 15 or 20 years, or 30 years in some cases, depending on the length of the bonds that we're issuing. Finally, we do note that we have a growing Education Stability Fund, which is our budget reserves, and that is something that we'll hear a little bit about when we get into the weaknesses, as being one of the key things in terms of their credit rating of the state currently. And I think this is something that will be coming more and more apparent to those in the future, is that we have basically dealt with our need on pension reform. And while we do have some health care, retiree health care issues, they're very, very minor in comparison to some of the states that have higher credit ratings in the state of Oregon. I've been reading reports of Michigan and Maryland, for example, of being in the $20 billion range for unfunded retiree health care liabilities. So, you know, we do have some issues, but they're much smaller. So I think that's something we're pushing very hard at the rating agencies to say, you know, we need to be given more positive strokes. Now let's turn to the weaknesses. Low budget reserves is actually the number one ongoing issue that the rating agencies talk to us about when we visit with them. I don't know if there's a magic number as to the percentage, but generally the rule of thumb has been 5% as a minimum. And as I look at NASBO reports, National Association of State Budget Officers reports, you can look at all 50 states and just look at what the combination of ending balances and rainy day funds for other states, and in general we're among the lowest. A second thing that they often write about in reports is our financial uncertainty associated with voter initiative activity. Will argues vehemently that we're a democracy and there's initiatives were invented in Oregon and we believe in them, but what they'll say to us is, that's fine. However, when you get a Measure 11 and Measure 5, it does things to your budget and it creates uncertainty for the future as to how you'll manage. I can point to the strong financial controls as sort of saying, well, the corollary to having some of these issues is that we have strong financial controls, but obviously in perfect world they prefer less uncertainty. They note that the 2% kicker law makes it difficult for us, even when times are good, to build up that budgetary cushion that they like to see. They do note that we have heavy reliance on a cyclical income tax for the bulk of our state general fund revenues. All things being equal, diversification is a good thing. So whether it's in your economic base or your revenue streams, it tends to provide more stability. We do have a moderate but growing debt burden as we address our most critical capital needs, and I'll show you some statistics at the end of my presentation that shows where we've been and where we are currently. And while it's fading from view, they did knock us for using deficit financing and one-time revenues to address some of the revenue shortfalls in the 2003 era. Briefly, I'll just touch on the bond issuance process, but Jack's going to go into more depth. We have disciplined debt management policies and procedures.
Excuse me.
Excuse me, sir.
Senator Bain.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, can we ask questions as we go along?
I'd prefer if we could to wait until I've concluded, but if you have a question,
I can wait.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Excuse me. As I said, Jack will go into more depth, but this little flowchart gives you very high-level perspective on the overall process. The State Debt Policy and Advisory Commission is made up of two legislators, the State Treasurer, a representative from the Department of Administrative Services, and a member of the public. It's their job to evaluate the current trends in the state's debt and economic and revenue environment, and to do a forecast of prudent levels of general fund and lottery revenue debt based on the state's existing debt position. The governor and the legislature will get that report fairly shortly, but we've done some preliminary analysis and we'll provide to you today what we think we'll be recommending. Obviously, the governor puts together based on proposals from state agencies as to their various capital needs, the bonding proposal, which Jack will talk about. The legislature, which is here now, is considering and approving budget and bonding proposals. At the conclusion of the legislative session, we'll create a bond bill. And that will basically incorporate what you're telling us in the State Treasurer's Office is your instructions to us over the next 2 years in terms of which projects you want funded and what dollar levels. We are the coordinator and issuer of all state bonds on behalf of state agencies, and we play a central sort of oversight and management role. And then finally, state agencies manage these ongoing bond programs and manage the bond proceeds and construction projects that are related to that. I can't go into great depth about the debt capacity analysis, but I wanted to give you just a broad overview of the four types of bonds, at least. We have general obligation bonds, which require voter approval. We pledge the full faith and credit of the state. Now, general obligation bonds may or may not be general fund supported. We have a number of programs that we do that are general obligation bonds under the Constitution that are self-supporting. Examples, energy loans. Another good example is veterans mortgages, where there's a revenue stream that repays the debt, but they get the benefit of the state's credit rating in terms of their interest cost. And in the case of the Constitution, most of the debt limits that are set up under law far exceed what it would be prudent for us to issue. So, which gives you a lot of reasons why we have a debt capacity commission to look and fine-tune and more hone in on what's really affordable. We have revenue bonds. These are all established by the legislature through statute. They're not secured by the state's unconditional pledge to pay, but rather we pledge the revenue stream to the various programs. Lottery bonds. Lottery revenue is the pledge. Highway user bonds, we use the gas tax and other highway user fees. There's a category called appropriation deficit bonds, and there's two different kinds of credits. There's appropriation deficit bonds, which is basically we promise to appropriate each year. We only use those once to balance out a piece of the 2002-2003 budget. There's also certificates of participation, which are used to finance real and personal property, and Jax manages and administers that program. We'll talk a little bit more about the details in a minute. Generally, most of the COPs that we issue are pledged from general fund resources, and so they're part of that general fund supported debt that we pay very close attention to. They're not secured by the full faith of the credit, but nevertheless, they represent a legal obligation for us to appropriate. They don't have as good a credit rating as a general obligation bond because it's not the full faith and credit, but they are generally well received in the market, and the state has a lot of COP debt outstanding, as you'll see in a moment. Finally, we have a number of conduit or pass-through revenue bonds. They're neither, the state is the issuer, but we have no obligation to pay. We're not responsible for the revenue streams, and there's no other state support. They stand on their own credit, but we do give them the benefit of tax exemption. This is really for your to keep, but this is a number of the constitutional statutory provisions of the different kinds of programs. And again, if you look at the constitutional debt limits, for example, state highways is $5 billion. And we have no debt in that category currently outstanding in GOs. But higher ed, for example, we have $2.7 billion based on the debt limits with $196 million outstanding. So it just gives you a sense and a scale for the size of some of these programs. Briefly, here's a big snapshot of 20 years of state debt. The blue represents general obligation bonds. 20 years ago, we had about just over $6 billion. Most of that was all veterans mortgage loan programs. That has been declining for the last 20 years. And what you notice is that the red, which is these direct revenue bonds, and the yellow, which are the appropriation credits, really didn't start growing until about 1999-2000. And as you can see, things are starting to go the opposite way. I did mention that we issued appropriation deficit bonds in 2003, and that's where the first big jump comes. But also in 2003, the state issued pension obligation bonds. We were able to borrow to pay an unfunded liability in the pension system at a much lower interest cost than would have been charged by PERS, and took advantage of that interest rate differential. But it did increase our debt considerably. On the horizon, we still have about $1.4 billion remaining in authorization for ODOT bridge and road improvements, so I do anticipate that even if we're paying off debt, in general, our debt is going to be going up. This just shows you some tables in more detail, and you can look at those at your leisure. I will make a point here on the revenue, direct revenue page, that the biggest growing piece for several years was the single family and multifamily mortgage bonds, which were funding low-income housing and first-time home buyers. That seems to have leveled off a little bit, and you can see what the real growing area has been highway user in the yellow, and that's going to continue, as I said, into the future. These are the appropriation credits, and you can see our COP use really started jumping in the late 90s as we undertook a lot of prison construction. And while that's growing in the last year or two, the appropriation bonds really pushed it up. Those appropriation deficit bonds will be paid in full in 2014. The Debt Capacity Commission, as I said, really focuses on the general fund-supported portion of the debt and wants to provide guidance to the legislature and the governor in that regard. We have a maximum target debt service, which is a practical basis, no more than 5% of the general fund revenue should be tied up in debt service so that it doesn't impede the flexibility of the legislature to manage through those budget downturns, because it becomes sort of a fixed cost in the state's budget. As of the end of the fiscal year, our general fund debt service ratio was at 3.7%. Preliminarily, and we haven't published a report yet, our forecast, and in that forecast, we look at the general fund revenue forecast of the state economists, and then we forecast out 6 years. So based on that, for the 07-09 biennium, the maximum amount of additional debt capacity, not necessarily that you need to issue it, but the maximum amount that you can issue and stay at 5% is $847 million. Now, that's an interesting outcome, considering a few years ago we had a number in that price roughly range in the last legislative session, a fairly significant amount of debt was authorized and will be issued. But revenues have grown so much between the last legislative session and now that it's almost like we've refilled the bank, if you will, in terms of capacity. In the case of lottery bonds, we have a legal bond covenant, and the legal bond covenant currently says that debt service cannot be more, you need to have 4 times lottery revenue to the debt service, so you have a 4 times coverage requirement. We also have a moral obligation for lottery-backed bonds that if for some reason if lottery revenues just fell off the planet, the legislature promises to appropriate money to replenish a debt service reserve fund. So there's a couple layers of protection for bondholders. As of the end of the year, fiscal year, our lottery debt service coverage was 7.4, which was considerably higher than the 4%, 4 times coverage, which leads to a rather astonishing result. The lottery revenue forecast has really grown quite a bit, and based on the December forecast, we have $1 billion in capacity. Again, I'm not suggesting that the state should issue that. If you did, we wouldn't be able to issue any more lottery revenue bonds for quite a while, but the revenue forecast has really pushed that number quite a bit in the last year. Now, the rating agencies try to do a yardstick of comparing the state of Oregon's debt to other states. Not every state has lottery bonds. Some states have their highway stuff in the general fund. So they've come up with a concept of net tax-supported debt. That's any debt that's supported by any tax. And it's a way for us to try and compare in a little bit more apples-to-apples approach. And I'll show you some statistics on that towards the end. And then lastly, we have this non-tax-supported debt, and these are programs that just are self-supporting. There's no concern that there's ever going to be a problem. The state treasurer's office is tasked under statute to review the cash flows of every state agency that wants to sell bonds before every transaction. So we make sure on a case-by-case basis that there's always sufficient coverage for housing bonds. There's always sufficient coverage for energy loans. Laura. So we don't focus too much on that.
Laura.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks. Excuse me. We're pushing the time schedule, and I don't know how long.
I will wrap up.
Thank you.
In your literature, you can look and see this is the various programs that provide general fund supported debt. Currently, $2.6 billion outstanding. What we add for this net tax-supported debt that the rating agencies look at is all the pension obligation debt, not just the general fund-supported portion, highway bonds and lottery bonds, $5.4 billion outstanding. This is just a summary sheet that shows you that. Finally, this is just a snapshot in the last few pages of where we stand on a net tax-supported debt per capita basis compared to 50 states, and you'll see that we've grown quite a bit. Even without pension obligation bonds, we're right above the median for 50 states. And as well, when you look at net tax-supported debt as a percentage of personal income. With that, I'll conclude my remarks by just reiterating that I think we're well managed, but we need to manage our debt capacity carefully. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura. I think I'll debate that question and then and I may make a comment. First, as you can see from the time schedule that they've allotted us, we go through these presentations obviously quite quickly, so don't linger on the questions, I guess.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I've got about a half dozen questions, and I'm going to hold it aside. I don't feel privately about taking the committee's time right now. We'd be here all day. You've raised more questions in my mind than you've answered, and that's okay. I'll talk to you privately.
Okay. So I think as we get into the general presentation, we will be dealing with the going to give you more in-depth questions, I'm sure. Thank you for responding.
And I just wanted to reiterate that you're always welcome just to call our office down downstairs or stop in, and we'll be happy to answer any of your questions directly.
Can I ask one quick question?
Yes, please.
Just on the lottery forecast and the $1 billion, was that also looking out 6 years?
Yes, it was. And all I was showing you was the maximum amount.
Right.
And so over 6 years, I think we have a negative $1.4 billion. So you might, we'll be talking to the commission about averaging it out.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Kenny. Representative Jensen, my name is Jack Kenny. I'm the finance manager at Budget Management Division. How long would you like me to take, or how short?
Well, I'm sorry. I guess maybe you folks don't have our schedule. This was scheduled from 8:30 to 9:10.
All right.
So
I'll try and get through in 5 minutes or so.
We can fudge it a little, but help me where you can.
All right. Will do.
Could you help me with that?
All right, thanks. My first page is controls on bond issuance, and a lot of the things that I'm going to cover, Laura has already covered, so I'll move through them quite quickly. Controls on bond issuance, just to give you an overview, so when that you are making your decisions as legislators and policymakers, you'll know what's out there that you have the power and that maybe the federal government or someone else does. There's constitutional and statutory limits on the amount of outstanding debt we can have at any point in time. So depending on the program, those limits are there on how much debt we can issue. You, as Laura mentioned, you also set the limits that we can issue in any biennium through the bond bill, and I'll get to that a little bit more in a minute. Then, even if things were approved during the session in the bond bill, that seemed like a good idea at the time, the state treasurer reviews every individual sale. So once we get out of the session and into when the bonds are issued, the state treasurer has an opportunity to review any transaction to make sure that it's still appropriate. Market forces are in play. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the bond bill, but obviously if the market conditions aren't appropriate to issue bonds, then the agency likely won't issue them. It also limits the amount of things. I mean, if there's not a market for the housing or for the industrial development bonds, obviously we won't sell them. So market conditions are another control, if you will, on our bond practices. The federal tax code limits what you can do with tax-exempt bonds. So typically there's the tax-exempt bonds are issued for capital construction-type items and not for working capital. Laura mentioned one of the exceptions. There's all sorts of exceptions to the tax rules. But generally speaking, the tax code limits what you can do with tax-exempt bonds, capital items, certain grant programs, and also limits the amount of time that the bonds can be outstanding. And then the Security and Exchange Commission regulations require that any state agencies that issue bonds make appropriate disclosures in a timely manner for material events and other required issuance. I'm going to spend a little bit more time on this slide, probably most of the time that I have, because I think this is really where this is how you're going to see things and how the process works. I've got in the top left corner of this diagram, Capital Planning Advisory Board. Most bonds, as I said, are issued for capital projects. So in the interim, probably 6 months prior to session, or 6 months prior to when the agencies develop their budget, the Capital Planning Advisory Board looks at their capital needs. It's a board that consists of both private sector and government officials who have an expertise in real estate and capital planning. So they'll review the agency's budget, look at what the agency's plans are for capital expenditures, and give recommendations, issues such as rent versus buy, and what to do about deferred maintenance issues and the like. The large box, then, is the agency budget requests. So the agency is going to ask for what they think they need in their budget, and that might be capital construction, capital improvements, equipment, grants and loans, or unique agency needs like ODOT or housing, economic development, things that they need to run their program. Kind of on a parallel track, though, and this is what Laura's already mentioned, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee is meeting to determine how much debt capacity is out there. So obviously every agency is going to advocate for its own programs and try and meet the needs of its constituents, but that has to be balanced by the amount of available debt capacity. So the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee, like I said, on a parallel course, determines how much is available. Those two factors are used as the governor develops his budget. So he is going to prioritize you know, given all the needs that are out there and all the agency requests, look with what he can do within the parameters or the sideboards of debt capacity and make his priorities and determine what he believes should be moved forward. And those, and so then I get down to there's a list of boxes. And that's really what I think the Ways and Means Committee is going to see. This is how you are going to see capital construction and debt capacity when you're doing your jobs on the subcommittees and on the full committee. There'll be agency appropriation bills. Those will include debt service, paying principal and interest on debt. It'll also include capital improvements, and it'll include grant programs. So there'll be limitation amounts for those particular items. House Bill 5005 is the bond bill that Laura's mentioned. That's where you will see the limits that you can establish on how much debt should be issued for the 2007-09 biennium. So that's going to be in House Bill 5005. The capital construction bill in House Bill 5006 will have those projects that are typically related to the bond bill. So you will see in House Bill 5006 individual construction items that agencies have requested. And just as a note, and you probably know this, so I apologize in advance, but a capital construction limitation, once you approve that, it's a six-year limitation. So in some cases, the capital construction bill will include all the costs that are needed to complete a project over 6 years. In other cases, such as the state hospital this time, it's phased. So the capital construction bill will only include phase one in House Bill 5006 this time. It's such a large project, and there's so many policy decisions that you all need to make that it's impossible to determine what the six-year construction needs of the state hospital will be, so that will be phased. There's a similar to the capital construction bill, higher ed has its own capital construction bill. So for community colleges and the institutions of higher education, there'll be capital construction bill unique to that those institutions, and that's going to be Senate Bill 5516. Then there's also lottery bond bills. We put most of them this time in House Bill 5036. That's going to include most of the authorization for projects that will be funded through lottery bonds. There'll also be one other bill for the Connect Oregon. And then sometimes you will see various constituents bring forward bills that require or request lottery bond funding for projects. The North Bend Regional Airport was an example in the last biennium where that wasn't in the governor's budget at the time, but it was brought forward by interested parties, and that required lottery bonds. Moving quickly, bond issuance authority. The Constitution really limits the amount of debt the state can have. And I'll try to be quick here. I think you probably know this, but the Legislative Assembly shall not lend the credit of the state, blah, 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 more than $50,000. But then there's notwithstanding. And there's several notwithstandings you see below, 11A, 11F, 11G, 11H, IJ. I didn't list all the letters in the alphabet that are the exceptions, but what I did list here is the ones that are in the governor's bond bill as he's proposed. So there are amounts in these there will be amounts in the bond bill for each one of these categories, and I won't belabor that. I'd be happy to answer questions afterwards. Laura mentioned one of the big ticket items that's not in there this time, but because we did it one time, was the 11O bonds for pensions. So that's one that you don't see here. We issued the $2 billion a couple biennia ago. Moving quickly forward, there's other bond issuance authority that you're going to see in the bond bill. Direct revenue bonds, I think Laura talked about that, so I'll skip through it pretty quickly. Transportation for the continuation of the OTIA project is the large one there, of course, the largest one. There's also, and direct revenue bonds are supported by the program revenues. So that's why gas tax is going to pay for those bonds or mortgage payments for the housing program. If economic development loans money to a local government for infrastructure, the repayment of that will be used to repay those bondholders. Pass-through revenue bonds, go through quickly. Those are ones where the state puts its name on a project that has a public interest, but there's no liability to the state, and there's no there's no program dollars. It's pretty much a standalone issue. So if it's an industrial development bond, it'll be that private sector company that is creating jobs that is responsible for the payment. But in order to entice the business, for example, they would put the state's name on it and get the tax-exempt status. And then finally, certificates of participation in other financing agreements, those will also be in the bond bill. Laura has talked about those. That is I'll get on that more in a minute. And then private activity bond issuance authority, that is, there is a certain amount of tax-exempt authority that the federal tax code allows each state, or the Internal Revenue Service allows each state, and that's allocated to agencies in the bond bill. So that covers the bond bill and what's going to be in it. Moving along to certificates of participation, again, Laura has covered those to some extent. They were initially authorized in 89. Constitutionality was upheld in Kane versus Goldschmidt. Significant increase in use after Measure 11 for the prisons. They are to finance real and personal property and certain infrastructure. It is one form of an appropriation credit payable solely from available funds. And that's why that's, you know, the notwithstanding how the Constitution limits the amount of borrowing that the state can do, technically this is not a debt. It's an appropriation credit. It is not secured by the full faith and credit of the state. The obligations to make payments to bondholders are subject to legislative approval, consequently has a lower credit rating, and Laura talked about credit ratings. But what they are is lease debt. So even though there's a requirement that the legislature make the appropriations, the way the bondholders protect themselves is they have a leasehold interest in, say, the prison or a prison. So if we were not to if you were not to appropriate the money for COP repayments, then the leaseholders could come and kick us out of the prison, and I don't know what they do with it, but they'd probably find someone else or some other use for it, and we'd be stuck without a prison. Pardon me?
Or borrow again.
Or borrow again, correct. And also, anyway, not to get into the next page just kind of shows where what we have done right as of December 31st. There's $1.07 billion in outstanding COPs, 64% of that to corrections. Not a surprise. Moving to my next slide, lottery revenue bonds. Again, I'm going to have to really hurry to get through this, but there's the purposes for it. It's a special obligation. I think Laura's covered this pretty well, so really no need to other than to... Yeah, I think Laura did pretty much cover all this. Other than to say that the lottery bonds, and I think she mentioned it, but just to reemphasize it, the repayment of lottery bonds really has first dibs, if you will, on lottery revenues. So once they pay for the prizes and the administration of lottery, lottery bonds are next up. So before you can do anything else with lottery revenues, you got to pay the bondholders. And there's also the moral obligation. Laura covered that. She covered the four times coverage test. The reason I'm covering COPs, lottery, and then the next one, 11G bonds with a little more specificity, is these are the ones that are have the most, I guess, discretionary money associated with them. 11G bonds, construct, improve, repair, equip higher education and community college buildings. They cannot be used for buildings that are wholly self-liquidating or self-supporting. There's another program for that, which is the 11F bond program. That's one that the treasurer will review to make sure on a transaction that before they sell the deal, that the 11F bond might be for a dorm or something like that where the fees pay for it, or a parking structure at a university. There is a general fund match requirement for 11G bonds. It's not always what I put in print in quotation here is a standard general fund appropriation. It might be matched with lottery bonds in this budget, for example. Currently, there's $189.4 million in outstanding GO bonds. The chart on the next page is kind of similar to the one Laura did, just for 11G. It shows kind of a mature bond program where the debt service is somewhat level and then tapers off. Obviously, 11G bond, not obviously, but they're typically 20-year bonds. So, issues on the horizon. This gets into the issue that I kind of kicked off my remarks with, is there's obviously a lot more need in the state than there is debt capacity, and so as you make your policy choices, these are the types of things that may or may not be financed with debt that you'll have to wrestle with when reviewing how to use these funds, as the governor did. Replacing the state hospital, the next major prison, in the 2009-13. And the hospital, that will probably be over several biennia. It could be 2 to 3 buildings. Those decisions, I think, are yet to be made. Next major prison in 2009-13 biennia will be constructed. The wireless interoperability network, big ticket item. Again, that will be phased over probably three biennia. Deferred maintenance at state institutions, including Oregon University systems. Those needs are significant, as anyone of you that tours the campuses know. And the governor's made a significant investment in his budget in addressing deferred maintenance. Higher ed and community college projects. I think it had been last biennium was, or the current biennium was the first time in several, probably at least a couple of decades, that investments were made in community colleges using 11G bonds, also in higher ed. OT initiative for highways and bridges. Connect Oregon for our non-highway infrastructure, such as barge terminals, rail spurs, airports, and the like. Normal state building needs, and the capital remodel would be an example of that. Local government infrastructure, the OECD bond bank. Computer system needs, the judicial systems. There's funds in the COPs for the judicial systems computer network, for example. And then seismic bonds, something that was authorized, I believe, a session or two ago. No money in the governor's budget for that, but they're still studying what the needs of the state across the state are. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. You've done yourself well to get through that much material in that amount of time. And, I think probably, are there any pressing questions? If we need to move on, I realize Mr. Crummel has something on his mind. Can it hold, Jerry?
It's a pretty quick question.
All right.
Jack, on the lottery bonds, are they matched?
There is no match requirement for the lottery bonds.
Not matched. Maxed.
Oh, I mean maxed.
Are they at maximum now?
No. Chair Jensen, Representative Crummel, no. I believe the governor's budget includes about $443 million in proposed lottery bonds issuance, and the September State Debt Capacity Advisory Committee had, I believe, $1.12 billion in capacity for the next 4 years.
And if I would add to that response, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, is again, those are capacity issues, and so anything that is tied up in debt is not available for just discretionary allocation. But and so that is one reason that Laura's made the point that these are capacity. We don't necessarily use all capacity because it does then take a long time to pay those down.
Thank you, Representative. Any other? Thank you very much, and I appreciate the difficulty you had in getting through in the time allotted, and my apologies that I didn't announce that to you before you got started. Then I think we have next up Peter Shepherd and David Hartwig.
Did you unplug my computer?
Sure. Where is it?
Members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepherd, and as I'm getting the computer set up here, I'll share with you an old trial lawyer's adage, which is never try in court a demonstration that you haven't exhibited in your office first. And the biggest example of that is the principle that if the gloves don't fit, you must acquit. You can call that as well. So hopefully I'll have a little more success here.
I think we're going to have about 1 hour scheduled calls for right now, about 15 minutes to the hour for you to make a presentation again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
members of the committee. I think I'll just begin with the paper and then let the electronics catch up with us.
I thought I saw the defense attorney rising, too.
I didn't see Mr. Cochran enter the room, Mr. Chair. So. Members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm joined here by David Hartwig from the Department of Administrative Services. In the next 15 minutes, we're going to give you a whirlwind tour of some of the litigation risks that you may need to grapple with as you make your decisions over the course of this session. You should have in your materials then a handwritten or a handout showing the each of the slides. I'm going to start with a just an idea of the limits of this report, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I have excluded from this report significant litigation issues that simply have policy consequences that don't carry with them significant fiscal issues. I've also excluded what I would characterize as routine risk management cases. These are the cases that we can predict in the aggregate, but individually probably don't have budget driver implications. And finally, I've excluded matters where the fiscal impact is really extremely speculative. I want to give you just a brief historical perspective on the question of litigation as a budget driver. A key takeaway issue is that it's inevitable. You're going to have to make hard choices this session that are going to carry with them litigation risks. And I've given you a couple of examples that past sessions have confronted that had those characteristics. Litigation also is unpredictable. There are going to be things that occur that you can't predict and can't control. And I just, on this slide, wanted to suggest a couple of markers that perhaps from the perspective of the Department of Justice, you might be thinking of as you're evaluating legislation in terms of its potential litigation impact. If you have someone presenting a proposal that involves some form of innovative accounting, or you're dealing with a proposal that your legislative counsel tells you is uncertain or exists at the edges of established law, or if you're perhaps find yourself in the situation of needing to resolve a difficult political question by substituting some intentionally ambiguous language to help find common ground amongst different interest groups, that's likely going to be a potential point of litigation impact in the future. It's not saying those things are bad for you to do, it's just that you need to be aware that those may contribute to a litigation risk in the future. Of course, some litigation suggests an opportunity as well as a problem, and I'll mention several of these in the context of things that you potentially could do by legislative action to resolve them. I'm going to mention seven areas, which is about a minute and a half per area. And bear in mind, of course, that we'd be happy to provide you with a lot more background and detail about any one or more of these areas. The first area is school finance or education, and I've highlighted here in the text of the relevant part of the Constitution the key part that really is at issue, and that's in Article 8, Section 8, and it's the proposition that the Assembly must, quote, publish a report that either demonstrates the appropriation is sufficient, that is, for school funding, or identifies the reasons for the insufficiency. In the Pendleton School District case, a case that has just now reached the Court of Appeals after trial court proceedings, the school district contended that what that constitutional provision means is that the Legislative Assembly must sufficiently fund schools, however that is defined for purposes of the Constitution. The state's argument is that the Legislative Assembly complied with Article 8 by publishing a report which explained the reasons that the Assembly didn't fund to the established level. And the trial court agreed with the state's position. In other words, it sustained the judgment that your predecessors made last session. That case has been appealed by the school district to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals could render its decision in that case before you adjourn this session, but an appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court is almost certain, and getting final resolution of this in terms of an Oregon Supreme Court case is, I can suggest to you, is almost certainly not going to happen before you adjourn. want to turn to the second area, what I characterize as the remedies cases, and these cases depend on the interpretation of two elements of the Oregon Constitution. And again, you have those there in your materials, and you don't have this on the screen behind me. The first of these cases, and probably the most significant, is a case called Clark versus Oregon Health Sciences University. The key issue here is a part of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which permits when the state is sued and individual defendants are also sued, individual state actor defendants also are sued, permits the state to substitute itself for those individual defendants, so that instead of being a lawsuit against individual persons, or as in the case of the OHSU case, against doctors employed by OHSU, the lawsuit becomes one against the state of Oregon alone. That's significant, very significant from the plaintiff's standpoint, because when the state is an individual defendant, the liabilities are capped by the Oregon Tort Claims Act. And Mr. Clark, a young man, through his guardian, contended that that substitution and the resulting cap resulted in depriving him of a substantial remedy that he is entitled to under his interpretation of the Oregon Constitution. So the court, in the Court of Appeals, agreed with that argument. The state has joined in that litigation and is seeking and has participated in the arguments in the Oregon Supreme Court, which were just concluded in January, earlier this month. And again, this case it's conceivable this case would be decided before you adjourn, but it is, that's not certain. It depends on how quickly the Supreme Court issues its opinion. And much depends for its consequence in terms of fiscal implications on how the court explains its opinion. So we really can't say at this point for sure what the implications are, but it is a potential budget driver for you. Hughes versus PeaceHealth is another case involving caps under a statute. This limits recovery of non-economic damages for the wrongful death of an individual. It doesn't directly involve the state, although the state is participating, but it does involve a challenge under those same constitutional provisions that I mentioned a minute ago to a statutory cap on the amount that a person can recover. And so this is a case to watch in terms of a potential budget driver, because what the court says in this case could well have implications for the Tort Claim Act more broadly. The next area is tobacco. And there are two issues here in tobacco that are potential budget drivers. One is the non-participating manufacturer diligent enforcement area. And this, in a nutshell, arises out of the master settlement agreement that the states entered into in 1997 with a number of, basically all of the major manufacturers of tobacco products. Some manufacturers do not participate in the master settlement agreement, and the state has a variety of interests in trying to encourage them to do so. The state has done so by passing a statute called the Non-Participating Manufacturer Statute, and basically what it does is eliminate economic disincentives to participation in the master settlement agreement by requiring manufacturers who don't participate to pay into an escrow account about the same amount of money as they would have to pay under the master settlement agreement if they did participate in the master settlement agreement. There are a whole bunch of adjustments that attach to the payments that the companies must make under the master settlement agreement. Those payments are due every April 15th annually to the state, and last year the unadjusted payment would have been about something around $77 million if it had been received in full. One of the adjustments is an adjustment for market share that the companies lose to non-participating manufacturers. The state can insulate itself against the effect of that adjustment, that is to say, avoid any reduction in our payment, if we diligently enforce that statute that requires deposits to the escrow account. That's why this issue is known as the diligent enforcement issue. This is a hotly contested issue between all of the states and all of the companies, as you might guess. The payment that Oregon received in April 2006 was about $9 million less because of this adjustment and because of this dispute than we otherwise would have received. I can't tell you that this issue is going to be resolved during this legislative session, and indeed this issue is likely to be repeated every April as the companies contest and assert successive claims to this adjustment. There is a possibility that this dispute could settle between the states and the companies, but that's very speculative at this point. The second tobacco issue involves punitive damages, and here the short version of this is that the state is entitled by statute to 60% of punitive damage awards that private parties recover against other private parties in lawsuits. In two cases, Schwartz and Williams, the families of smokers, recovered judgments anyway, against Philip Morris, and the state is entitled to a share of those. The company's Philip Morris asserts that it's entitled to reduce the payment it owes to the state under the Master Settlement Agreement for the share that the state will receive of punitive damages. That's presently on hold pending resolution of the final resolution of the private cases, but that's a potential dispute that could drive down the amount that the state receives from Philip Morris pursuant to the Master Settlement Agreement. Next area, Measure 37. This is a potential budget driver in two ways. First, there are claims processing costs that DOJ, DLCD, and the Department of Administrative Services, Department of Conservation and Land, Department of Land Conservation and Development, and the Department of Administrative Services are incurring to process the many thousands of claims that have been filed with the state. In total, the amount of these claims is staggering. It's in the billions. It's worth getting separate briefings on Measure 37 because the size of those dollar claims is subject, whether those will ever be real claims that the state owes is pretty speculative and subject to all kinds of contingencies. We have litigation in the area of Measure 37 that may help resolve some of the present uncertainties. One of those cases is the Griffiths versus Oregon case, and there's a little summary of that in the materials that you have. Next area, lottery. We have a significant development recently from our Court of Appeals in the Wolf versus Oregon Lottery Commission. What the Court of Appeals concluded was that rules setting the compensation for retailers in 2004 were adopted by the Oregon Lottery without an adequate record supporting its rule. Now, that has this, on its face, that case only affects a relatively small number of retailers. If the Oregon Supreme Court adheres to that opinion on appeal, and we are seeking appeal, then there could be consequences for many more of the existing contracts that Lottery has. Again, that's an issue that probably won't be resolved before you adjourn. PERS. The PERS issue arises under Article 1, Section 20, which is in layperson's terms, the equal protection element of the Oregon Constitution, though the analog to the federal equal protection clause is not exact. And the cases here are the Pinkerton and English cases, and these are right now in the administrative phase. The next step would be appeals to the Oregon Court of Appeals. The gist of the issue here is whether these individuals who are former partners in domestic relationships that would have been marriages but for Oregon's prohibition against same-sex marriages, whether Article 1, Section 20 requires PERS to grant them the same options that a couple who had been married and now are divorced have under the PERS regulations and under the PERS statutes. And this is an issue right now that's merely in the administrative phase. It could be a significant budget driver in this respect. PERS, of course, is a tax-exempt fund. The IRS is the agency that determines whether that tax exemption will continue to exist, and the IRS has an array of rules that could be construed to say that if the fund changes its process now and grants these claimants the benefits that they seek in these administrative proceedings, the PERS fund's tax-exempt status could be endangered. Now, that's many steps down the road in the litigation, but that's the potential budget driver here. It's very unlikely that that will reach any definitive decision point before you adjourn, but that is an issue that ought to be on your long-term horizon. Last area, employment. This is the lingering aftermath of Young versus State of Oregon, and it has to do with some legislation that the Assembly passed in 1996, or that applied in 1996-97, and an error occurred in that legislation, which resulted, from the state standpoint, was an error, but the court held that that was a very clear statute, and what it did was grant overtime pay to employees who the state hadn't thought were entitled to it. And as a result of that, the state has been held liable not only for paying the overtime pay, but also for penalties. And so we have in this biennium the obligation of making good on some of those penalties. I'm done, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The last slide has some contact information, and we'd be pleased to meet with you and help give you a little more detail on what has necessarily been an accelerated review of these issues.
Thank you very much for the quick trip to representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this potential IRS determination that we've made too many changes, is it the substance of this particular change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clement, the statute, the way the IRS exemption works is that we submit the plan, including all of its elements and the rules, the associated rules, and the statutory framework that defines who's entitled to benefits and under what conditions. And then the IRS gives us a determination of whether they will treat the plan as tax qualified, tax exempt. And that has been done for the existing plan. In order for these claimants to receive the benefits they request, PERS would have to determine that a statute that forbids them from getting these benefits is unconstitutional. That statute is part of the terms of the plan that has been previously approved by the IRS. And in the pleadings we've submitted to in the administrative proceeding, we describe how we've obtained counsel, specialized tax counsel, who conclude that making this change could endanger the tax-exempt status of the plan.
Quick follow-on.
Maybe you could come talk to me at my office about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clement, I'd be very pleased to do that.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. Mr. Hartwig.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Hartwig. I'm administrator of the State Services Division within the Department of Administrative Services. I'm here to give you a brief overview of the status of lawsuits put together by our risk management program in our division. You have some handout material. The first page makes a reference to lawsuit status and Department of Administrative Services. On page 2, on the topics I'm going to briefly present to you, we'll do an overview of the tort liability claim outcomes for 3 fiscal years. We'll do an overview of 25 years of claim history. We'll do a 25-year look at the claim type and their distribution. We're going to put together a broad range of potential impacts relating to the Clark decision that Pete mentioned was before the Supreme Court, and then give you an idea of some of the risk management strategies that we're considering to respond to that. On page 3, you have the overview of liability claims for 3 fiscal years, 2004 through 2006. I'd like to take you to the left-hand column under claim outcomes. The first two items listed, claims settled and claims denied, are reflective of claims that have been received by the state and have been adjusted by the claims unit in risk management. Those numbers represent 91% of all claims that are submitted against the state. So 90% of those claims are adjusted, investigated, and resolved without litigation. If you go to the next item on the left-hand column called suit settled, and all the remaining 4 items that are listed there, those indicate the number of claims over these three fiscal years that were made against the state that worked their ways to various stages of litigation. When they go to litigation, Department of Justice picks up the case at that point and manages that litigation. Those claims represent 9% of all the claims that are filed against the state. But if you go all the way across to for those four categories to the total cost column on the right-hand side, the cost for those claims represent 84% of all of our claims costs. So not a high number of claims that go to litigation, but it is a high number of cost when those claims do reach litigation. Page 4, wanted to try to give you an indication of the percentage of total cost by claim outcome. So again, referring back to page 3, I hope I don't get you confused here or myself confused. On total cost, the number of claims settled by adjusting staff is 14% of all the costs. The percentage of cost for claims denied is 2%. And then you can work your way down through there. Suits that are settled make up 36% of all of our claims costs. We'll see trial with defense verdict is 6%, and trial with plaintiff verdict is 26%. Moving to page 5, regarding 25 years of history, 99.9% of all of our claims are valued at less than $500,000. Well, you'd expect this because that's the cap that's currently allowed under the Tort Claims Act. We've had roughly 30 claims over this period of time that were valued at more than $500,000, and these were claims that were employment practices or child abuse cases that found their way to federal court where our tort caps do not apply. On page 6, you'll see a distribution by claim type in the pie chart. So over this period of time, 39% of our claims have been related to employment practices. 51% are general liability, and that's a catch-all for a variety of things, from child abuse to inmate property damage claims to young overtime claim, for example. You'll see that medical malpractice is 7% and auto liability is only 3%. Going to page 7, we wanted to give you a sense of what some of the range might be of a potential impact of Clark. And so what we put together here is from an early preliminary actuarial analysis that was done in 2006, if the tort limits were to be eliminated, the difference between the current tort limits and no limits. And at the bottom of the page there, you see that the fiscal impact would be estimated for biennium 07-09, an increase of 73% or $74.3 million to go from the current limits to no limits. That's an extreme, but we thought we'd show you a wide range of what might happen with tort caps depending on the Clark decision. The last page wanted to give you an idea of some of the strategies that we're considering, not just related to Clark, but it did make us begin to look at what some other options might be. We're looking at the availability or the potential availability of purchasing excess liability coverage to protect the self-insured portion of our fund. We have a wide range of premiums possible to us, from $80,000 to $8 million annually. The $8 million would be, I would say, the absolute coverage of everything that might be possible. That would include general liability excess. It would include medical malpractice excess, employment practices excess, auto liability excess. Everything that we might want to consider, we could possibly buy for $8 million of premium costs each year. We really believe that in the long term, the self-insured posture and position that the state has taken over the last 25 years or so is sound, and we would like to continue to move in that direction and solidify the self-insured fund and possibly buy what we'd refer to as catastrophic coverage. For example, unemployment claims, we might buy coverage for claims in excess of $5 million. So we'd protect the self-insured portion of the fund. We'd protect the state against an unusually unexpected high cost by buying that insurance. There are some exposures that are not covered by insurance. For example, Pete mentioned the Young overtime claim. The defense costs for that are not covered in an insured instrument. Components of PERS litigation would not be covered in an insurance instrument. So with that, I'll conclude and take questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. I think we're already exceeding Laura by the next presenter by 4 minutes, so unless there are any burning questions, Rip, any correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, Dave, do you go outside, when you mentioned the cost of defense litigation, are you going outside the usage of state officials, and that's what increases the cost, or where does that cost come from?
Chair Jensen, Representative Girard, I'm not sure I understand your question. Could you...
Okay, in a litigation case, the state is defending itself, but you just mentioned additional defense costs, so I was curious where that came from. Do you hire attorneys that are not employed by the state?
I'm sorry, Chair Jensen, Representative Girard, no. All of our defense is done through Department of Justice, or if they designate a special attorney general, that's what we do in 99.9% of our cases. In fact, I don't know of a time that we've hired anybody that was outside of that arrangement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, the usual practice is that the Department of Justice provides counsel, and then Chapter 180 provides that the Attorney General may determine if there's a need in a particular case for either completely independent counsel or for us to go out and hire a private lawyer to serve as a special assistant attorney general. But the great majority of cases are handled by DOJ lawyers, and the costs, DOJ operates like a law firm, so we send a bill to the agencies to whom we provide service, including to David, who pays them regularly.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your presentation and for cooperating with us and getting through. At this time, we have federal budget risks and a lawyer, Laura Pryor, the Association of Oregon Counties, and I understand from an article I read in the paper that Ms. Pryor is going to become less active in this whole arena of county government. If so, that is certainly going to be a loss to the state of Oregon.
That's very kind. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur, the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties, and we're here today to talk about the loss of the so-called Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. Congress, 109th Congress, failed to reauthorize the act. It expired September 30th. It's commonly known as county payments or school payments or roads and schools bill. It brought about $254 million a year to the state of Oregon. It was designed to offset the revenues that were lost because of the curtailment of timber harvests in the national forests. The counties shared in the revenue from those harvests traditionally since 1908 when the forests were created. The loss of that funding hits county general funds, road programs, school funds, common school fund, and those shared services that the counties provide on behalf of the state. It's a very complicated problem because of the nature of the funding mechanisms under that act, the federal act, involves the loss of payments made to counties under the National Forest Act, under the Oregon and California Railroads Act, under the Coos Bay Wagon Road Program, for instance, involves payments based on historic forest revenues to counties. 33 of Oregon's 36 counties are affected directly by this act. I would say all our counties are affected, at least indirectly. It also will affect your state budget. As I understand it from Paul Warner, the revenue for at least one more year's payments were factored into the governor's budget. So there's a hole already. I'd like to introduce Judge Laura Pryor, who will talk to you a little bit about some of the implications of the loss of these revenues.
Thank you, Mike. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laura Pryor, and for 20 years I have been judge of Gillam County, which is one of the smallest counties in the state of Oregon. December 31st, I retired. I've agreed to stay on with the county to try to help them through this process, and one of the reasons I'm doing that is because our county has never had any timber revenues, and I know what that has meant to us. I know the struggle that we've had because of that. This is an extremely complicated process, extremely complicated issue, and I hope that our meeting here with you today is just the opening of the discussion that we're going to have that's going to go on between us to try to find solutions, because money isn't the only solution. Let me say that up front. The counties believe that. It's not just money. That's the most huge impact, but sometimes money isn't the only solution. So we've got to work our way through this. Mike mentioned three things. The loss of PL 106-393. That's the biggest impact. But that also affects the National Forest payments and the OMC payments. So it's not simple. So when you're looking just at the revenue side, that's when the impacts come. Now, what's the effect of that? Well, those monies are all used on both sides of a county budget. The road department side, which in many cases is the largest part of the budget, and the general fund side. Now, how that happens in each county, in 36 different counties, 33 different counties, is different in almost every county because of their circumstances. For instance, in your handout, you will see the amount of money that's lost by each one of those counties and the percent that is. Now, to complicate this further, let me give you an example of what I mean. In Harney County, you'll see what their loss is. But what you don't see is that over 77% of that county is owned by either the state or the federal government. So when you look at the loss, you have to realize that they can't grow their way out of that because they're only doing that on 27% of the land that can be used for society and to develop taxes. Lake County is another example. You see there was 78% of their county is owned by state or federal government. And my final example is here in the valley, Linn County. If you look at their loss, we have to remember that 40% of that county in the Willamette Valley is owned by state or federal government. So when we're doing the analysis, and that's what the Association of Oregon Counties is doing now, we're trying to collect the information and the data from each one of these counties and trying to figure out and do the analysis to tell us what is really going to be the impact and how is that going to happen. What we know for sure, and Mike has referred to, is this. We know that we're going to have system failures in the road system, the education system, and our shared services system. Another handout that you're going to be getting from us is this one, which talks about our shared services. How we move forward and be able to address the system failures the reduction in service, our ability to partner with the state to continue to deliver these services at the local level is what we have to all work together on now and into the future. We won't belabor any of this now because, frankly, we don't know. We really don't know. That's why we're in the information collection right now. The counties have gone into budget already. They are trying to figure out what it's going to mean to them, too. So as they work forward in the next few months, that information is going to be feeding back into the association. As we get that information, we want to be able to bring it to you. So there's two things that we'd like you to know right now. One is we need you to understand the system failure with us. And to do that, we've got to have some mechanism to be able to do that over time. Because when you go home in the summer, beginning of summer, this isn't going to be solved. We are still going to be struggling with this. So we're going to need some way to be able to continue this two-way dialogue and this information exchange. Because we believe, and this is the last thing I'd like to have you know this morning, we believe that the solutions to this are going to be multifaceted. There's going to be a number of different things that we're going to have to do, and we're guessing at some of that now. Some of it's going to have to be revenue, we know that. But we're also probably going to need structural changes, and we're also going to need flexibility in how we get to these solutions. And they don't exist now, that we know. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be very pleased to take any questions and hope to have and I can answer some of them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Byron. You've done very well to cover this topic in the limited time you had, and I'm sorry you were short of a long time. Are there any quick questions?
Just to make a comment, I mean, this is really devastating, obviously. I grew up in Coos County, and so Marion County, small percentage, but even my folks have been in to see me in Marion County, and it's real even here, but I look at my hometown, and it's just, I mean, it's really something else. So I will do whatever I can to help, and I think this is a real test for those of us who, you know, theoretically represent just urban districts on a map about this urban-rural divide, because this is an Oregon problem, not just a rural problem by any means. So please know, I think, you know, the sense of the committee that we want to do this. And also thank you for your work with the Public Commission on the Legislature. Many of you know she was the co-chair, and again, we had sort of a system failure occurring, a lot of us believed, and appreciative of your work and looking forward to the recommendations.
Thank
and I'm
you.
Glad you took this up in your retirement.
Did I see a Mr. Chair?
Sorry.
Yes, just a quick comment. Nice to see you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to listen to when you come in. The point is here that this is something we're all involved in, not just these rural counties. In my county, we're going to close the libraries down probably permanently. We're going to cut back our roads 50%, and we'll be cutting back on our law enforcement. We recently, you know, our next-door neighbor county, Josephine County, recently had a tragedy with the Kims. And part of that tragedy is because they don't have enough infrastructure to look for people, find people, don't have our roads posted properly. A lot of things that could be done aren't being done for financial reasons. When you travel these rural counties, and we all do that, you're going to find if this isn't resolved, you can't get in and out of those counties properly. You won't have the kind of police protection we look for and expect. And if you get lost out there, you're likely to be on your own. And this is something that affects all of us, not just those counties we're talking about here. These counties are inundated with all kinds of needs and problems like any part of the state is. But when you've got 50, 60, 70% of your property non-taxable because the state and federally owned, you just don't have the base to run your county on. So it affects us all. Don't feel we're insulated from it. This is not a rural urban divide problem. This is an Oregon problem. And we're going to have to deal with it in that way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did I say questions, Senator Wickett? Okay. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you.
And again, thank you for your years of dedication to
thank you.
The counties, to the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it.
And for your continued work.
Thank you.
After your retirement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we have completed the agenda that we were given, and we will be adjourned.